Towers and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm your host, Shelley Brisbane. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. Well, friends, we're going to talk about another musical tonight. We haven't done a musical in a while, so if that floats your boat, stay with us. And if it doesn't, just stay with us anyway. It's going to be fine. And I am so excited to have two great guests, one of whom is brand new to the show, one of whom is returning. They host a podcast together called Let's Face the Facts. And my first guest, because I always introduce the new person first, is Matthew Arter, co-host of Let's Face the Fact. Matthew, welcome to the show.
I so appreciate top billing, Shelley. I don't know if you know that.
But I do now.
I'm so glad to be here. And I have this to say, if a musical discussion does not float your boat, who hurt you?
Yeah.
What was your upbringing?
You tell them, Matthew. That's true. My other guest, a former Lions, Harris & Shield guest, and he came back, which is so exciting. It's David Almeida. Second billing.
Hello.
But we love you anyway. Hi.
Oh, no, my pleasure to be back here. I loved getting to talk about Kiss Me, Kate. And now here we are back again, being a musical guy for you. That is a treat and a great honor, Shelley.
I really appreciate both of you being here. Well, our musical tonight is There's No Business Like Show Business from 1954, 20th Century Fox, starring the great Ethel Merman, Dan Daly, Donald O'Connor, Bitsy Gaynor, Johnny Ray, some other people that we'll get to. And I chose this movie at the behest of David and Matthew, because when I was on their show, we talked about what we might like to do in the future. And they were like, OK, we want to talk about Ethel Merman. And so There's No Business Like Show Business was obviously a right up there on the top of the Ethel Merman movie list. And so that brings me to the first question I always ask on Lions, Towers and Shields. And you guys were more familiar with this movie than I, but I still want to hear your answers. I'd love to know how familiar each of you are with this movie. How many have you watched it a lot? Is it one of your favorites? What's your connection to this movie? I'll start with you, Matthew.
Thank you for asking. You don't know this, or maybe you do. I don't know if I've got the angle right. I'm sitting in front of my 27 by, what is it, 42 movie poster of There's No Business Like Show Business that hangs on my wall. And I'm sitting here with the cast recording, or the soundtrack, if you will. And it's a special LP because Marilyn Monroe, it says Ethel Merman, Donald O'Connor, Dan Daly, Johnny Ray, and Mitzi Gaynor. And not pictured, it says, and Dolores Gray, not in film. Because A, the rumors are Marilyn didn't do a lot of her own singing, and she was not under contract for who did this and who did the recording. I have my autographed photo of Ethel Merman. There she is, my dear. I've got one biography of Ethel. I've got two biographies. I've got the autographed biography I have of Ethel's autobiography. It's autographed by her. It says, to my best supporter, Ethel Merman. There. So I come to you in this podcast as an Ethel Merman expert, more than a There's No Business Like Show Business expert. And I had it on VHS because at the time, Call Me Madam wasn't available. Irving Berlin was all tied up with a bunch of like legalities of his stuff. Annie, Get Your Gun wasn't available on VHS or anything. And this was, after falling in love with Ethel Merman at a very young age, the first movie I got to see her in, like full Merman, the Merman-iest of Mermans. This is like her heyday. So I love this movie. And I watched it a lot.
I know that you have a drag persona as well. Do you ever do Ethel Merman?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course. Can't not. But I say, I sing live, but I grew up learning how to sing by Ethel Merman. So I'm a belter, and I just naturally have a wide vibrato like she does. So, and my grandmother would get stopped and asked if she was Ethel Merman a lot. And she sounded like her and looked like her. So when I see Merman, especially like the 60s Merman, I see my grandma a lot. It's like a visit from my grandma. So it's a very nice, warm, happy feeling when I see Ethel Merman.
I love it. Well, I will defer to you on all matters of Ethel Merman trivia because I will just say stuff and you'll go, Shelley, you're wrong. And that's totally fine. So
take it.
And now a reading from the Ethel Merman autobiography to correct the record. David, how about you? Did Matthew convince you to watch this movie, or were you a fan before you and he talked about it?
Oh, I've been a fan for many years also. Matthew and I are both actors by trade, full-time working in Orlando here at various theme park dinner attractions. And pretty much if there's a stage somewhere and they'll pay us, we will perform on it. And so because of getting into musical theater in high school, of course, once you start the musical theater drug, as it were, as a performer, you can't avoid Ethel Merman. She is still kind of the quintessential voice of historical Broadway. You know, like nowadays we have your Audra McDonald, you have your Patti LuPone still in there. But I mean, one of the first shows I did in high school was Annie Get Your Gun. And then the year after that, we did Anything Goes, as a matter of fact. So my introduction to musical theater was the shows written for her. And as Matthew said, her stuff was not readily available when I was growing up, because what little film work she did do, it was tied up in whatever was going on with Irving Berlin. So we didn't really get to see much. This was one of the few things you might catch on a Saturday afternoon on a UHF station. So I'm a big fan of this. The movie, it is the most beautiful mess. I just love it so much. And I have so many criticisms of it. This is Shadows of How I Talk About the Facts of Life on our podcast, where I love it to death. And I will then talk 90 minutes about all of the criticisms and rewrites that I want to do.
That's what we love. That's what we love. Yeah, I think I had seen this before, but it had been a really long time. And by Call Me Madam, I'm not sure that's available, because we talked about doing that and I looked for it. And I was looking both on streaming and on physical media, and I'm not even sure you might be able to get it in some odd way through a back alley British DVD or something. I don't know, but I wasn't able to find it. This one's fairly easily available both on streaming and I actually bought a Blu-ray because I'm obsessed with physical media, apparently. So that's it.
Yeah, Call Me Madam's available on DVD.
But, is it? Okay.
But I have it, yeah.
It's okay. Just one of those musicals that Call Me Madam is so dated. You think this is dated. Call Me Madam is so dated that it's almost impossible to really do the show anymore because of the script. It's just so of its time. Every joke is about... Like, there's jokes about Harry Truman's daughter's singing career.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Well, it is a political satire, really, at its core. And Berlin, for some reason, loved writing those. Because if you look at the later shows he wrote in his career, you have Lady Liberty and Mr. President. And it's just like, oof. Not that the reason why you should write a musical is because of longevity, producibility, revivability. But these are shows you just can't do. There's just no sense because of the politics in them being so of their time.
Yeah, and it isn't even them. I mean, and it's a lot of shows like this, there's just dated, uncomfortable stuff. But yeah, if you're talking about Harry Truman's daughter, that's going to be a little heavy lift for a 2020 audience. And I don't even think, like, some of that stuff, I suppose you could find a way to fix, but probably not. And there are a lot of other things you could revive. So
yeah, they did. And they soft pedaled a lot of it for the film. They did try to kind of take a little bit away to make the film more generic. And it's still much too. There are so many in jokes. But George Sanders has a gorgeous baritone voice, and you watch it going, wait a minute, this is all about Eve, that foppish queen?
I love George Sanders. I really do. I'd love to see that.
If you've never heard him sing, Shelley, it is a revelation.
Oh, I have to see it.
And you will not believe. You're like, why did they never let him do more musicals? He is fantastic. And acting like he's in love with Ethel Merman, which is no small feat for any actor of the time.
Oh, yeah, and we'll get to Ethel Merman and Dan Daly. I have things to say. So for people who aren't super up on Ethel Merman, I think it's fair to say, yeah, she didn't have a lot of films. She was mostly a Broadway actress, and she had made films as far back as the 30s, but there weren't very many, and they weren't very good. And she had even done Irving Berlin before. She did Alexander's Ragtime Band in the late 30s, which is this really long, long film, and some of the songs from there repeat here. But so it was kind of a big deal that she was doing this musical in 1954. This is the heyday of Technicolor musicals and 20th Century Fox and MGM, some of the other companies too. But they would make a few really big splashy movie musicals, and you'd have to have huge stars. And so Ethel Merman, a Broadway actor, comes, and Dan Daly, who's like a movie hoofer, is her husband in this. And oh yeah, Marilyn Monroe, who it's funny that when I listed the cast, I didn't mention Marilyn Monroe, especially. Oh yeah, Marilyn's in it too. I forgot. Not that she's forgettable at all. There's a lot to say.
Yeah. On the DVD, it is her. It is literally a picture of Marilyn in it. Matthew, isn't it part of like the Marilyn collection?
Yeah.
Some releases have called it, and it's like, oh, really? You're calling this a Marilyn Monroe movie?
Interesting. I mean, she had so many musical numbers. I guess that's probably has something to do with it. I mean, because she's doing something that's interesting in that way. I liked this better than I thought I would, because I had seen it a long time ago, probably, but I don't have a very good memory of it. And I just sort of looked at the pieces of it, and I feel like it ends up being greater than the sum of its parts in ways that I didn't expect, because the story is pretty, we're going to go through the long history of a vaudeville family. And that's, has that been done before? I think so. Will it be done again?
A couple of times.
Yes. Yeah. and even with Dan Daly, there's a movie called Mother Wore Tights from like the late 40s that Dan Daly and Betty Grable are basically doing something like this, where they're this couple that goes through all this, you know, mishigas to have a vaudeville career. And it's like, wait, we're doing this movie again? But we've got Ethel Merman and Dan Daly as a married couple, and they have three kids who are kids for a brief moment, and then they grow up to be Donald O'Connor, Mitzi Gaynor, and Johnny Ray, so that they can perform and be part of the troupe. So, yeah, basically we have a show business musical that goes from 1919 to World War II, basically, and that's so that you can get both vaudeville and, although in this movie, vaudeville, except for the depression, vaudeville doesn't really die. It's like there's a depression, but then it kind of comes back, which I think is kind of funny.
Yeah. Now, I realize the closing of the Hippodrome was an actual event. That was 1939. Yeah. So this movie takes place in those 20 years. But boy, if you could think of a subtitle for this movie, I would call it The Billionaire's Vaudeville. Because even from the very first number, when we just see Ethel and Dan doing their Choo Choo Alabama number, the background, take a look at the background, how lush and layered and greeting card and painted backdroppy, all the sets. And I've heard the word overproduced used to describe this movie. And my God. Matthew and I will tell you, as, you know, theme park actors, as regional actors, you play a few upholstered sewers on the way up. And the fact that this family is from day one always playing on in front of these multi tens of thousands of dollars backdrops and the costumes and the props. And it's just like, I don't think vaudeville ever looked this shiny and polished ever.
No, I agree with you. And the whole thing is, I mean, they threw some money at it, clearly. And it's funny because there are some things that are recycled about it are the Irving Berlin songs, because most of those songs, as we said before, have been in other places. But they spent a lot of money on it. They spent, you know, they got Marilyn Monroe, who was going to be the draw. It did make money. I think it made something like $5 million, which I don't know how to compare that to other musicals of the time. But it wasn't a failure. And it seemed to be mixed in terms of how critics reacted to it. Some people loved it. Some people were offended by Marilyn Monroe doing Heat Wave. That seemed to freak people out because it was the 50s.
We almost can see her belly button.
Oh, my God.
Scandalous.
Alert the media. So as I say, it's a Broadway story. Ethel Merman and Dan Daly is a couple. It's full of musical numbers more than most musicals you will see. There is certainly talking between. It's not an opera by any operetta by any means, but the proportion of musical numbers to the rest of the movie is quite high, especially given that it's an hour and 17, it's almost 2 hours long. It's 117 minutes, which is pretty long, even for a musical of this type. So right away, we're thrown into Ethel and Dan singing. And the thing that surprised me most is that I like them as a couple. I think they have chemistry, and I was so surprised by that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, they're great. I did look up, you know, from our podcast, I'm obsessed with the ages of actors.
Me too.
Particularly old-timey actors. Did you look it up,
yes,
too?
Yes, I did.
So Ethel Merman is 46 years old here. So she is the right age to play a mom in Hollywood to these kids who are supposed to be in their early 20s. Dan Daly is 39.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, wait, what? He is only 39. He looks like he is in his mid-50s. Easily.
I have a real life story, a gossip story from the movie To Lay on You Later, which will blow your mind in that regard.
Okay.
We'll get to it because we want to talk. We have to get to Donald O'Connor before we can get to that story.
Okay.
But
cool.
Yeah, so all of the people who play their kids were born in the mid 20s. And so, yeah, Ethel and Dan, if they had had those kids, Ethel would have been like in, you know, 20 or 19 or something like that. Or actually, I'm doing my math wrong, but she's just right on the cusp of. But yeah, Dan does seem a lot older. He always did, though. He's like, I mean, he did these. Betty Grable was kind of his partner in 40s movies, and they're all those movies are really mediocre. Betty Grable, not that interesting. I always found Dan Daly kind of annoying in the way I find Jack Carson annoying. But like I say, in this movie, I think he kind of knows his role. Like, he knows Ethel's the star, and he knows he's supporting her both literally in terms of being her partner in the music numbers, but also even when he's acting, he's just mostly kind of being the strong, tall kind of dad figure. And I think he sort of plays it about the right level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. And it's as actors, Matthew and I always say, you're only as good as your scene partner in any situation. And I think it really did help Ethel to have this veteran film actor on her side, because by all accounts, everyone says Ethel Merman was so big and broad and loud and brassy as a stage performer that there are times in her films where it's just she just can't completely turn it off. And I think she has a few really lovely scenes and some scenes where she is just playing the background, not taking center stage. Some of the jokes do get punched a little harder than they need to be. But yeah, in general, I think I'm with you. I think their chemistry, I believe them as a couple. And I think that was very good casting.
Matthew, what do you think? And what do you want to say about Ethel in this movie?
Well, one of the things that I loved about it was that because there are shows within the show, you got to see how Merman looked on a Broadway stage when she performed, rarely turning her head to acknowledge her co-star. And you can see even videos of her in the 60s when she would do TV shows. It's straight ahead for Merman. And I remember a story about her in Annie Get Your Gun, the 66 revival, where Jerry Orbach, she thought, was stealing focus from her. And she sent him a note that said, stop doing this business off the side. And he said, I'm reacting to your lines. And she replied, I don't react to yours. You don't react to mine. So I loved the chance to see on film what Merman looked like when she was in a Broadway show, standing there, bark and bark, and do the bits, do the choreography, but always straightforward, looking out the corner of her eyes at her co-star. So I loved their chemistry, and I thought that I bought it. I'm not mad at it.
Yeah. Casting wise, that was spot on. Some other casting choices in the film we will be discussing, I'm sure.
And we can go there shortly. And I just wanted to say, I think too, that because there's so much music in the movie, and when we start out, I actually like the first couple of songs, the little Alabama song, which is where she and Dan Daly are first singing and dancing and hoofing, and you sort of are aware now these are partners. And then they do the little medley thing, which I think is a little bit weaker, but I just feel like it's a good introduction to them as a team, as a couple. You know, whatever they're going to be like as a couple, you don't know, but at least as performing partners, they're doing well. They're doing great.
Well, they just cram. I mean, that's an Irving Berlin thing, to cram every God forbidden song he ever wrote into the show. And it's like, even there's a scene where Merman's doing a commercial. Let's have another cup of coffee and let's have another piece of pie. It's an Irving Berlin song. It's like, there's a whole song and they just use little snippets of it. And it's like, I think that's one of the reasons people had a problem with it, because by the time this came out, Top Hat had come out, Easter Parade had come out, Blue Skies had come out, Alexander's Ragtime Band. And it's like, write a new song, Irving.
It's kind of true. And I mean, I felt like I'm not a huge Irving Berlin fan, but I think I realize that part of that is because I've heard him so many times.
That's exactly people have such a hard time now with jukebox musicals. And it's like, what do you think every Irving Berlin show was, for God's sake?
Oh, yeah. And among the many Irving Berlin songs just stuffed in there is the instrumental version of Putting on the Ritz.
Every dance scene, every nightclub, there is the underscore were other songs too. Like, this is wall-to-wall Berlin. Yeah. It is amazing there's as much plot in scenes as there are in it. I did do a little bit of a deep dive, right, piggybacking on what Matthew was saying. One of the, you know, and you can't trust the internet when it says some said of the time that maybe the Berlin catalog was getting tired. Well, my research says that we had starting in 1942. 1942 was Holiday Inn. 43, This Is the Army. 46, Blue Skies. 48, Easter Parade. 50, Annie Get Your Gun. 1953, Call Me Madam. And this movie came out in December of 54. October of 54 is when White Christmas came out.
Yeah. He's making bank, Irving was.
Yeah, but we have 8 Berlin, some with new songs, some without, but 8 Berlin big movie musicals in 12 years here. I'm thinking, yeah, I think the term they use now is franchise fatigue.
Exactly. And he wrote a couple new ones for this movie as well.
The Tattoo song is new. Matthew, what is there? Are any of the others new?
Tattoo is new, I want to say.
Was the Johnny Ray, was the If You Believe, that sort of religious revivalist number? Was that one of the new ones?
I think that might be where we rhyme Doubting Thomas with whatever it is he rhymed with. So she's like, that's terrible. My research is that there are 2 new songs, one of which I can't remember.
I think it might be that the Believe song.
I think
the one
right.
that Johnny sings at the party.
That seems highly specific to this show, don't you think?
I mean, exactly. That's why I suspect. I don't know. But
in fact, it sounded kind of Johnny Mercer to me. Like, because it's sort of like religious triumphalism, kind of, yay, God's awesome. Mm-hmm. Except it's a generic sort of God written by a Jewish guy.
exactly.
Of course, that's not new for Irving Berlin either. So,
no, and White Cole Christmas. Porter did it. I mean, it's certainly, you know, been done. So
totally. Well, so we have our couple who Dan Daly is doing sort of intermittent narration. Sometimes I forget he's narrating the movie because we're going to go forward in time a lot. And every once in a while to bridge us, Dan Daly will say something. And then we did this and then there'll be visuals that indicate what they did. But I think it's kind of choppy. As I say, there's several cases where he does that. And like, why is he talking now? Oh, right. He's narrating. I forgot. Because there's so many other things going on. There's the musical numbers and there's little bits that start here and there. But it's like, oh, then we had some kids and then we went through the Depression and Ethel was singing Have Another Cup of Coffee, which reminded me of Judy Garland, A Star Is Born, where it's like, this is what I did before I became a big deal, right?
And then they sent their children off to a private school.
Right.
And then they bought a gigantic house in New Jersey. It's like,
as
what?
You do.
Okay.
Right.
What job do these actors
have?
I know actors today with full-time jobs who still can't afford a house.
They're doing real. And there were no great theme parks for people to work at that time.
No. It's so funny. I'm just like, where did all of the money come from for everything? You know, Ethel Merman, I think that's supposed to be her nightgown when she's got the big draped thing around her shoulders, the bow right at the middle, and fully boned corset. And then
as you
fully,
do.
It's like, yeah, it's like this. I think that's supposed to be her lounging around the house dress. And I'm like, that probably cost $40,000.
they were very fancy. They nod at the Depression, but they seem to have gotten out of it okay. And as the Depression is ending, the kids are old enough to we see them, I guess, as teenagers. We don't really see the kids. We see that the kids have gone to this fancy school and the kids would like to come home with their parents, please. But that's something that would be a dramatic point in another movie. In this movie, it's just stated, hey, the kids would like to come home, and that's the opportunity for them to do so. And then we're going to meet the adult children, late teens to early 20s, whatever they are, who are Donald O'Connor, Mitzi Gaynor, and Johnny Ray. And we should talk about some of these people.
Yeah, and you said it would be a plot point in another movie. What they're setting up is that the baby of the three, which is Donald O'Connor, they set up that he's sort of the conniving one. What Ethel says to Dan is, she says, "Didn't you hear what the man said? He's trying to tell us we have a little gangster on our hands." So he's supposed to be the shyster, the conniving one. And other than being a bit of a womanizer later, I didn't really get that carried over into him as an adult. So it was just kind of a little narrative cul-de-sac
there.
He's
a little smarmy. Like, that's my impression of him. It's not that he's like a gangster or a grifter or whatever, but just that he's kind of smarmy. And as you say, he's a womanizer. And then we have the other one that's the serious student, the boy played by Johnny Ray.
Bless.
Which... Oh, my Lord.
Oh, bless. Could we talk about
go ahead.
Johnny? I mean,
jump in.
It's not just that he is in over his head. He was a pop singer. His biggest song was Cry in 1951. So he's still kind of, you know, the Justin Bieber flavor of the month pop singer of his time. So to give him this, and I mean, he is just god-awful.
He's terrible.
I think. Terrible.
I don't know how the narrative of the story came together, but my sort of headcanon about it is they looked at his acting style, in air quotes, and they said, okay, he's very soft-spoken and very kind of, let's make him the one that goes off and does something else and that may be more serious-minded, and then we'll make him a priest so that we don't have to see him for a good third of the movie. And he despite the fact that he's a singer, he has one number, like he's in some group numbers, but he only really has one number that's his own, and then he's gone for most of the movie, and then he comes back for the finale, and then the point at which, because I should just say too that, like, for the first two-thirds of the movie the plot is very insignificant and substantial and very light, and then in the last third of the movie it gets to be more dramatic, and his deciding to go off to be a priest is kind of the beginning of that dramatic part, which I guess we'll get to. But yeah, acting not his strong suit. And he's, as like as David said, he's a singer who his big hits were in the early 50s, and somebody wrote, and I like the way they put it, I said he's sort of the transition figure between the crooners and the rock and rollers, because this is like right before Bill Haley and the Comets and Elvis and all that kind of stuff. So yeah,
oh yeah, that's absolutely. Yeah. And the other thing is that Merman was not really a dancer, but you see, she keeps up pretty well. She does very well for herself in this movie. The others are all dancers with a capital D. Johnny, you can see he is struggling just to march in time and walk with the others and trying to, and because he's on the end, the way they have to configure them, you can see this awkward shoulder elbow sticking out on his end of the lineup, where at the other end, Donald O'Connor, who is just so physically natural and in his comfort place. It's just, oh, Johnny, I often find myself kind of looking away from the screen. Like, Johnny's performance is, it's embarrassing to the point that I'm like, oh, I don't know if I could watch this.
Yeah,
he was partially deaf, first of all.
Or was he?
He was partially deaf. Tony Bennett called him the father of rock and roll. He was this like rhythm and blues kind of like Elvis without the charisma or charm, I guess. But he got his start like in African American clubs in Detroit. So it amazes me that he has no rhythm.
That's weird.
Bless
That's
his
really
heart.
Weird.
They asked him, somebody asked him later on in his career why he didn't make more movies, and he said they never asked. And it's like,
this is his last actual movie of any substance.
Yeah.
The way it reads, I think he perhaps made some movies that are more minor, but 20th Century Fox never had him back, and he never made another major motion picture. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bless his heart.
And yeah, and certainly, yeah, this performance was not bogged down with charisma, talent, masculinity. That's the other thing. That's the thing. And as gay men, we can talk this
Absolutely.
Way. I just want to preface this
by saying,
be my
masculinity consultants, gentlemen.
But like you said, how soft-spoken he was. I mean, Matthew, please correct me if I'm wrong, but when you first saw that scene with him coming home and saying, "Mom, Dad, I've been out walking all night, and, well, there's something I need to tell you. I've thought a really long time about this, but it's really who I am." I mean,
I met a boy. You know,
yeah. But that's it. And then their reaction to it, the fact that, you know, we're theater people are pretty naughty, potty mouthed, crass, awful people. So, yeah, you don't get much overlapping of religion and performance. But the fact that they are like, you know, the father is like, you know, what do you mean you're going to throw your whole life away for this? And it's like their reaction is he may as well be telling them I'm gay.
Right. But I think, I mean, that's supposed to be the joke, right? Because theatrical people in another lifetime, you know, parents of children of an insurance agent would say, I'm going to go join the theater. And the insurance agent would say, no, you're not. I'm going to. So I guess that's supposed to be the joke. But it is funny, the language, if you put it in a sort of maybe he's gay subtext.
Well, at the time, he was being arrested at several places for just that. So,
So that was hitting very, very close to home. Yes. Even though there are rumors that he may be fathered Dorothy Kilgallen's third child.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Did you read this?
Wow. I missed that one. That's excellent.
Yeah. But yeah, there's a juicy tidbit for you.
I know.
But yeah, and that's the thing. And with him going off and being, they're funny jokes, but they beat them to death. The whole thing of, well, if you think about it, it's just a different theater, but a longer run. And, you know, where are they assigning you? I don't have a parish yet. Well, you make sure they give you a good house and it's not out in the boonies and all of these. Yeah, exactly. Theatrical, you know, the church and the theater. Oh, they're both kind of the same thing, aren't they? No.
So I neglected to talk about the writer and director of this, and I think we should probably talk about Mitzi Gaynor first so that we can be a little structured here, and then we can go back and talk about the Efrons and Walter Lang. So Mitzi Gaynor, I actually didn't look where this is in her movie career. She's definitely a dancer with a capital D, as you know, as O'Connor is. And I think her performance was fine, like the acting performance, I mean. But yeah, she's definitely holding up her own in terms of the dancing in the movie. Have you seen her in other things?
Mitzi Gaynor is an old school hoofer, and she's one of those triple threats that everybody had to be back then, but she's also just bland enough to put her in whatever you need to put her in, like Shirley Jones was at the time, and and Vera Ellen, for God's sake.
Oh, God, yeah.
I can't tell them apart.
Yeah.
Right?
I still go, like, which
blonde
is
women
Mitzi
in the
Gaynor,
50s.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Betty Grable, the same way.
Mm-hmm.
They're all the same, but Mitzi's the only one that's still kicking.
Still.
That's right. I looked at, she's the only one that continues to survive. There's a joke on Lions, Terrors, and Shields that I have the ability by mentioning, and I don't do this. People bring up somebody's alive who's in the movie, and then very soon after, they expire.
Oh,
so
God.
I don't want to do that. Mitzi, stay with us. I'm supposedly to blame for Angela Lansbury, and I'm not going to take it. Daryl Hickman is still alive, as far as I know. We talked about him in Keeper of the Flame, but anyways, so sorry to friends and family of Angela Lansbury. I did not do it. It's not my fault. So,
but Mitzi is, you know, the most iconic role that she'll always be remembered for is really not her. It's so funny that this is the type of this sort of young, somewhat sassy, streetwise hoofer character. She also plays a similar role in the remake of Anything Goes 2 years later, when she and Donald O'Connor are love interests and not siblings. Ew. And she's also in Lay Girls in 1957, but South Pacific 1958, plays simple and humble Nellie Forbush. And it's such a different role for her, and yet that's the one she is best remembered for. And I love her in this movie. I love how fun and sassy she is. And again, next to Johnny Ray, she's Meryl Streep.
That's a fair point. There's no comparison between her and Johnny Ray. She more than holds her own. She's great in the musical numbers.
Exactly.
I found her bland is kind of the word that I came to.
Yeah, I don't think I could argue that.
It's not a great part. I mean, to be honest, like, she has a role to play. She's the daughter of the family who is obviously part of the act, and she will marry toward the end of the movie. But she really doesn't have a lot to I guess the point where there's conflict about, Donald O'Connor staying out all night and Johnny Ray becoming a priest and stuff like that. She has a few things to say, but she really doesn't have an arc particularly. She's just kind of there, you know?
Yeah. And then she later the peacemaker between Merman and Monroe.
Yeah. Yeah.
They have a man walk up and see her performing. He's like, you know what? I think I'm going to marry that girl. And he goes, okay. And
sure.
Then the next scene, he's like, would you like to go to lunch? She's like, okay. And then the scene after that, he meets the family. Father Donahue, right. Would you perform a wedding? I'm going to marry her. Okay.
Because we have to resolve, especially female characters, we have to pair them off by the end. Or if it's a male character, make him a priest, you know? So,
yeah.
So we have to sort that
mm-hmm.
out.
Yeah, either make him gay or make him a priest. Let's go with the priest.
Yeah, not gay in the 50s, probably not. So we talked about Donald O'Connor a little bit, and I'll share my little bit of gossip. Donald O'Connor had been married to a woman named Gwen Carter for about 10 years at this point, and they were separated when this movie was being made, and she was dating Dan Daly and would end up marrying him.
Yeah.
Thereafter.
Wow.
So relations were not good on the set, shall we say. Besides, and so Merman and Monroe, we'll talk about Monroe in a bit. They had issues, as did Daly and O'Connor. And I don't know specifically, other than just I don't really like you, what those issues might have been. I mean, you know, how it manifested itself. But in any case,
Merman and Monroe. Merman was a workhorse,
yes.
A professional. She came up through the ranks of the stage and Broadway, so she did not suffer fools gladly, and she had no tolerance for the delicate flower that was Marilyn, who would show up to set late and would need her acting coach and would hold up production. Merman was like, what in the, you know, this is your job, do your job.
Right.
So that was part of what was going on there. I also, to piggyback while we're in the gossip corner of this episode, I did read in one anecdote that Mitzi Gaynor didn't care much for Marilyn Monroe because Marilyn kept flirting with the guy that Mitzi was dating, whom Mitzi would eventually marry. But apparently Marilyn kept coming on to him and she's like, girl, she is mine. he is mine, rather.
Yeah. That's interesting. So, and Monroe is married to DiMaggio at this point, and I think he comes on set at some point.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and so tempestuous stuff going on. So, yeah, we should talk a little bit about Marilyn Monroe in this movie. She had made, why is it escaping me?
Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
She had just made Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. They wanted her to do another movie that she did not want to do, and she was suspended from 20th Century Fox, and finally they got her to do this movie if they would promise that she could do The Seven-Year Itch after, and so that's how they got her. And she, as you were saying, David, exhibited the Marilyn Monroe behavior, where she has to have her acting coach on set, and she's late, and she's, you know, temperamental or fragile or whatever you want to say.
Had to have her own costumes designed,
right.
Had to bring in her choreographer for her numbers. And
So I can imagine it was a tense set. And she, you know, Fox, obviously, they had planned to cast Sherry North, who is somebody else who's sort of generic and in musicals in the 50s. I don't even really have anything to say about her. But then they had the opportunity to get Marilyn, so they did. I don't know anything about whether she sang her songs. To me, it sounds plausible, like the voice sounds plausibly like her, but I wasn't listening for is it or isn't it. Somebody who is definitely doing a Marilyn impression if it was not her.
Well, it's one of those things where, like in Roz Russell and Gypsy, she swore till the day she died that she sang those songs in that movie. And as many people that agree with her will say that was Lisa Kirk that did that. So the fact that Dolores Gray is on the soundtrack, and I think it was like a Marnie Nixon situation where they might have mixed a little bit of her voice in, like they did with Audrey Hepburn for a couple songs, just to give Marilyn the sweetness to her voice that she didn't have. But that Lazy song, it's like Carol Channing singing it, for God's sake.
It is. There's this lisp thing that is weird.
Yeah.
It's just That's the only
not
place.
Lazy. Lazy. Yeah.
It's the only lazy. Place that I noticed it. I mean, the heat wave thing, I mean, again, I'd have to go back and listen with that in mind, but that seemed plausibly her, but the lazy song was weird. It was very odd.
Well, Matthew, on that soundtrack album you have, it's Dolores Gray singing the Marilyn songs.
Yes.
Does it sound like it does in the film? Because Dolores Gray had a pretty distinct voice of her own, didn't she?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, I haven't listened to this cast. I mean, it's an album, for God's sake. I don't have a...
Yeah.
Or I don't have a
pull your turntable out.
What do I have to phone? Yeah. pull out my phonograph? But I will say
78.
This. I will say this about Marilyn. And I think if Merman had known what was going on with Marilyn, because there was... That was not a happy relationship she was in.
Right.
She was also a newer type of actress. So, like, it's not uncommon, I don't think, nowadays, for an actor to have. Cher wore her own stuff in burlesque. Is she a bitch? You know what I mean? Like, sorry. Cher wore her own stuff in burlesque. Is she difficult? You know? So it's like... Marilyn, I think, was going through it at this point in her life with DiMaggio not being very nice to her, for lack of a better term, physically or mentally. When he visited the set, he said, no photographs with Marilyn. I only want to be photographed with Ethel. Really? I mean, so I think if Merman, going through what Merman went through with some of her marriages, had known what was going on in Marilyn's head, I think she would have been a little bit kinder. I like to
that
think
that would have
anyone.
Been great if she had been, if she could have been an ally for Marilyn.
Right,
I think
right.
That would have been so awesome for the movie and probably for Marilyn herself.
Yeah. To have, to have Merman on your side in a movie musical, I think.
Oh man.
But I think she was just going through so much that Merman had no idea. And we didn't have any idea, you know, nobody did. So I give Marilyn a little bit more credit than maybe I should.
I mean, it doesn't hurt to do it. It doesn't serve anybody to say, you know, Marilyn was terrible or had ego or whatever. I mean, she probably made things difficult on the set, whether it was for cause or not. I mean, I'm sure the other performers and the director and all of that did have issues to contend with. So,
oh, I'm sure.
For whatever reason.
Marilyn's character was so interesting because this Victoria Hoffman, who later becomes Vicky
Parker.
Vicky Parker, yeah. The idea that she reinvents herself. It's too bad that Marilyn didn't have the acting chops to pull this off, because this was written pretty well, that she knew what she wanted. She was very fixated on her career. And she's no dummy, even though that's what people think she is. It was, you know, probably somewhat autobiographical there. But the fact that Donald O'Connor pretends to be a magazine reporter just to get into her dressing room, and her thing is like, tell you what, tomorrow, why don't I call you at the magazine and we can do our interview then, knowing full well that he's BSing her and all that stuff. I wonder how Marilyn's career would have gone had she lived to shake this persona that I think is – I'm not a big Marilyn person. I don't know a lot about her. And, you know, as a gay person, I'm required to know some to keep my pink card. But I've always felt that she, as an actress, always kind of – had this like chokehold, this stranglehold on all of her performances, because every performance had to contain that public persona and that certain speech pattern that she had supposedly created for herself. Supposedly that's not how she talked when she was off camera. So this was this persona that she never fully shed to get into a character.
Is that her fault,
you know,
or
what I'm
is
saying?
That the studio's fault?
Around her, the directors who had expectations about what a Marilyn performance was.
Yeah. Let's be honest. I mean, Bette Davis, one of the great, quote unquote, greatest actresses of our time, she's kind of always Bette Davis, isn't she? And you get, you know, Clark Gable was Clark Gable in every movie he was in, for God's sake.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I see that as more of a, that's how actresses, Marlena Dietrich, Christ, good Lord. Mm-hmm. Marlene Dietrich was playing Frenchie with a German accent in Destry Rides Again, for God's sake.
Yeah. I think Marilyn in this movie, I actually find her performance, I agree with you. I think the role is really well written. And I find her performance uneven, but in some places I really like it. And it's in the scenes where she's interacting with Donald O'Connor, whether it be that dressing room scene, even the first scene when she's a hack check girl and they have that interaction and she's performing and because she wants to be a great actress. And so she's practicing her diction. Yeah. And I like the way she delivers that. And then late in the film, when she basically says, I'm going to choose my career over, you know, going to dinner with Donald O'Connor, which sets off the dramatic part of the end of the film. But I really think there are places in this movie where you can see her acting chops and even her intelligence. And intelligence is not a word that Marilyn Monroe gets gifted with very often. But I think she was a lot smarter than given credit for, especially given situations where she was, you know, feeling happier or comfortable or more comfortable than she often did. I mean, there are movies like Niagara or Don't Bother to Knock, where you can kind of see that. Those are full dramatic performances. She's not trying to be a musical comedy star in those movies. And those are, you know, even Asphalt Jones. There's like four or five movies that she did within the first 5 years of her career that are not big Marilyn Monroe movies, but you can see her has either learned a great deal from her method acting classes and having her acting coach around, or is a naturally gifted actress who just didn't get the opportunities to play to that skill.
Yeah. And like Matthew said, a lot of it could be the studio and, you know, all the public, the external pressures she had to maintain this public persona. So, that's why I was saying it's a shame that she died so young, because what interesting role she could have played in her 40s and in her 50s and, you know, could have gone on to do in a time when there would have been a point in her career when she would have been like, I can't do that anymore. That doesn't make sense if I'm going to be playing a mom or a grandmother or something. See, well, you know, what would she have been like on The Love Boat?
See, and I, forgive me, she would have been exactly what Mitzi Gaynor was on The Love Boat, or Ann Miller. But the thing is, here's the thing, the time period, had she lived longer, would she have fallen into the Joan Crawford, Betty Davis, hagsploitation films of an older woman, God forbid, in her 50s in Hollywood in the 60s, you know, which would we have had a Marilyn Monroe what's that Betty Davis movie that was just frightening? Stepmother, or that horrible, her last movie that she did.
Yeah, Wicked Stepmother. Yeah.
God,
Would we have had that from Marilyn Monroe? Would we have had what was that Joan Crawford, Zorg, or
Trog.
Would we have had a Trog?
You look at Rita Hayworth, who was younger when she made her last movie, but it was the same kind of thing. She was in A Great Wrath of God, and then, you know, I guess it would depend on how much Marilyn had wanted to act or had needed to financially. I mean, Betty Davis and Joan Crawford were both just, they couldn't stop, I feel like. And in different, sort of, they were motivated in different ways.
Yeah,
but
you're right.
It's kind of like they just couldn't help themselves. Yeah. And they should have stopped. And I don't know what Rita Hayworth's situation. I think she had not acted for a while, and then she got offered this movie and she took it, and she did not. She looked rough. She was in her 50s, and then, you know, somewhat later developed Alzheimer's and passed away fairly young. So,
or Dietrich in Just a Gigolo with David Bowie. Painted up like a clown. Just a gigolo everywhere I go. Come on.
Well, and she was doing live performances and in fact, like, injured herself, like, fell off a stage and, like, broke herself pretty badly when she was in, her 60s. And then she basically taped herself back together, not only her leg that she had broken, but her face. Like, she pulled her entire facial structure back with, like, tape and wigs and things. And just... Yeah. And she didn't need the money. Like, Dietrich was wealthy. Some people just need to keep doing it. And the question would have been, I guess, given Marilyn's mental health and everything, would those have been motivations for her? Or would she at some point have said, this is hurting me, I should probably stop now? Or who knows? We don't know.
Yeah.
So back to Marilyn in this movie. She plays a character that she's Donald O'Connor's love interest. They meet when she's a hack check girl that wants to be an actor. She's, as David said, she's very ambitious from the get-go. That is never in question. Initially, she tells Donald O'Connor to get lost, but eventually she warms up to him and they have this relationship. Once they have begun the relationship, there's a number where he's basically trying to, you know, get to come in or at least get to kiss her goodnight, and she doesn't want to, and so there's a whole huge number that evolves out of that. And at that point, it's clear that something's going on there. And there's even a line in that scene. This is why I brought it up, not because of the musical number, but there's even a line in that scene where she's basically like, "So what if I want to be like my dreams to be a famous actress?" And he says something to the effect of, "That's cool with me," which apparently it is not later on, because the whole sort of big blow up in their relationship is when she goes to a dinner to discuss a show that she's going to do, and says she's going to she's told Donald O'Connor she's going to meet him, but she doesn't, and thus Donald O'Connor spiral begins, and he gets drunk and he has an accident and the whole thing. And so this and the thing about Johnny Ray being a priest are the two dramatic pieces in the film, because the entire plot of the movie up to this point has just been sort of fluff between musical numbers, which is how I sort of figured the whole thing would go. And then we have these sort of two weird deviations into pathos, sort of kind of pathos, and different actors handle it with different levels of skill, shall we say.
I just want to do a little sidebar, if you'll allow me, is that one of the things that makes Donald O'Connor spiral is they do a good job planting a little seed that Lou Harris, the guy who ends up becoming Marilyn's manager and then eventually producing the show on Broadway and all that, they do plant the seed that he has some designs on her.
Fair.
And because she is an ambitious woman in the 50s and willing to do anything for her career, I think that's kind of a foregone conclusion. I should say a foregone question of, is she doing everything necessary to have him manage her career to the best of his ability? Lou Harris is played by Richard Eastham. Did you recognize him, Matthew?
No.
Do you know who he is, Shelley?
You know, the voice was really familiar and I couldn't place him and I didn't look him up. Tell me, David.
I have seen this movie so many times, dozens and dozens of times, and not till this viewing for us doing this did I realize Richard Eastham plays General Blankenship in the first season of Wonder Woman. He's the boss of Steve Trevor and Diana Prince, and that's General Blankenship. And I'm like, but he's so short on Wonder Woman, and he's tall here. And I'm like, oh, that's
right. Wait, is Lyle Wagner really tall?
Yeah, Linda Carter is 6 foot tall. Lyle Wagner is 6'3".
There you go.
Of course he was short on Wonder Woman. I'm like, duh. But I was like, so what a different role for him. And he is very dashing.
Yeah, he is.
Again, very good casting, because you're kind of like, well, if she did have to have an affair with him in order to kind of keep things going with him managing her career, she could do worse. He's not like one of those gross, disgusting agent guys. So, you know.
He's the one minor character, because this really is a small cast other than the people in the background of the musical numbers. But you've got the five Donahues, you've got Marilyn, and then you've got these other sort of showbiz pros, and he's one of them. And he's the one that stands out. And to me, it's sort of his presence. Like, he really has quite a presence on screen, and especially he's in the role of, you know, directing the show or being her agent or whatever it is he's doing at the moment. And he really is like a take charge character, and you pay attention to him.
Yeah, no, that's why it's such a different, even though he's playing a general on Wonder Woman, he's just kind of there in the sidelines. We know that Diana and Steve have got everything under control, that he's just kind of window dressing on that show. And before we get talking about the writer and the director, these are the lovely little continuing cul-de-sacs I love to go on. The song that Donald O'Connor sings after he gets the first kiss with Marilyn, I think it's A Man Chases a Girl Until She Catches Him. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that's one of the new ones, though. Now that we say that, I believe that's one of the new Irving Berlin songs.
Okay, then that's why it is such a big production number.
It is
so
huge,
crazy with fountains and living statues that come to life, and him climbing up plants and jumping off of two-story things and getting wet and all that. But here's the funny thing. Every other song in this film is diegetic.
Mm-hmm.
The song exists in a performance where people are watching it being performed. After the, I guess Marilyn's kissing abilities are so magical, he just suddenly turns to the camera and begins singing to us, the
and
audience.
Says, get me an orchestra. We have to do this. Right. Yeah, it isn't. And the scale of the number and the fact that it isn't on a stage, not just that it isn't part of her performance, but it's jarring in that sense, because there are other musicals where that would absolutely feel like it would make sense. But at no point when Ethel Merman's son becomes a priest does she sing to the camera.
No.
Which is good,
but,
I think.
I mean, they had to do... that's probably for the better, yeah.
Yes.
But considering Donald O'Connor, I mean, he had Make 'Em Laugh in Singin' in the Rain in 52.
Yeah.
And every film since, it's like they do it. They also give him a, you know, comedic number in Call Me Madam, where he's drunk and, you know, thinks he's been set aside by the woman he loves and all that. And so it's one of those big, I'm kind of boxing with the air while also tap dancing and doing backflips. And this is just falling in that, okay, well, we have to let Donald O'Connor do what he does, but it's a lot.
It is a lot. It's surprising. As I say, it sort of looks weird and out of place. It's not a bad looking number. I mean, it's great. It's Donald O'Connor. You get to see him dancing.
Yeah. But you're right. The scale of it is so beyond. And that's saying a lot for the scale of all the
yes,
other numbers, as I mentioned before. The scale of this, for it just happening in a place that's not a stage, supposedly in his mind. I mean, this is clearly supposed to be a fantasy. But even that, it is. I've seen this on television when they ran it on TV, and this number was missing. I was because I think it's like 10 minutes long. Mm. It's at least 5 minutes long. It might even be longer. So I remember seeing that number missing from TV broadcasts.
With a running time of 117 minutes and trying to fit it in a 2-hour segment. I mean, musical numbers are obviously easiest to cut, but this is the easiest of all the easy ones to cut. Probably the second one would be the Doubting Thomas's number, except that's Johnny Ray's only real big number, so I don't know whether they would have cut it or not. And apparently when they put it on television because of Pan and Scan, it was a real problem because you had so many scenes where the five of them were standing abreast, and so two of them would get cut off, and whoever was in the center, which was usually Mitzi and Dan and Ethel, I think the guys were typically on the ends. Apparently it didn't look great in the Pan and Scan era.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this movie was directed by Walter Lang and written by Phoebe and Henry Efron. They are the parents of Nora Ephron. And Lang directed a bunch of 20th Century Fox musicals in the 50s, including The King and I. The Ephrons wrote comedies. And I should say I have a sort of a special interest in this particular set of collaborators because they also did a movie for 20th Century Fox in 57 called Desk Set, which was a Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn movie in which a computer comes between Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, which is just as weird as it sounds. And I think Lang is a musical director. I mean, you guys have to tell me what you think. I'm curious, but I like the Efron script. I think, again, there's not a lot of dialogue relative to the musical numbers, but it seemed to be surprisingly well written.
I would agree that some of the bits and pieces, some of it you have to. Anytime you're doing a 20-year travelogue of a family history, you do need some shorthand for how angry Dan Daly was at Johnny Ray going into the priesthood. Remember, a few scenes later, Ethel is reading a letter sent to them, you know, well, here's how things are going in the seminary. And then the father says, yep, you know what? I'll bet you he's going to be the head of his class. It's like, you know, somehow, somewhere along the way, I now approve of this. And so you get that. But the actual dialogue and the jokes within the scenes, it's pretty sharp and pretty fun.
Yeah, it surprised me. I mean, it really did, because there are movies like this. And to me, it's a little bit of it is a shorthand. When I see somebody like Dan Daly in a movie where I don't expect a great deal, because he just made a lot of sort of schlocky 20th Century Fox movies with Betty Grable that were just terribly written and where you sort of actively don't care about the characters. But I don't know. I just thought this was a slight cut above. And I thought it was interesting that that's like the one in reading reviews and like even people who like this movie, they're focused so much on the scale of the musical numbers, which is right. And Merman's performance and O'Connor's performance, dancing and all that sort of stuff. And the ones that hated it are focused on hating Marilyn because God forbid she should, you know, dance in a suggestive way in the 50s. But nobody really comments on the Efron's writing or Lang's direction, which is, I think, pretty good.
Yeah, Lang did State Fair. He did Call Me Madam the year before.
Oh, he did Call Me Madam,
so
too.
Ethel, okay. Yeah, Ethel Hinton and Donald O'Connor both were in that, and they had worked on that before. And there's an interesting moment. I was watching Call Me Madam again recently where the love song between Ethel Merman and George Sanders, he sings it to her the whole time. He never takes his eyes off of her. And even though this is more of a stage thing, even on film in those days, they would do a thing where you start singing the song to the character and then you turn outward mm-hmm. and start, you know, bringing the whole idea to fill the room, as it were. That's a thing that, you know, typical and not wrong choice to make as an actor or a performer. And yeah, there were some directorial things that I think were really interesting in Call Me Madam. Some things, the actors locking arms and walking toward the camera as the camera pulls back that we saw at the end of this. Absolutely, he did it in Call Me Madam. I think it's in State Fair too, isn't it?
I don't remember that for sure because I'm not
as familiar with State Fair.
I've seen it, but I don't think there are as many like group numbers in State Fair. It's more couples in State Fair.
But even so, I
see it as a trope thing that he could have done. So,
but no, certainly a completely, you know, competent musical director. There's nothing wrong with anything he's done here.
Yeah. So, Matthew, we talked about songs that were new in this movie, but there were some that were cut, right?
One of the songs that was cut was Anything You Can Do, I Can Do Better.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
Which was a family number that they were going to do, you know, the mom and the dad, Anything You Can Do, We Can Do Better, and against Donald O'Connor and Mitzi Gaynor. But again, I would have loved to see that because I would love to see Merman singing a song from Annie Get Your Gun and what it looked like, you know. Mm-hmm. But I loved how you said Donald O'Connor has this bit where he does his songs to the camera. And I thought, well, Merman does that the entire movie. So
that's just what Merman does.
Yeah.
Even, whether there's a camera there or not.
Yeah.
Well, talking to what we were talking about when I said franchise fatigue, the other thing is this is 54. Berlin had been a famous performer-songwriter since the teens.
Yeah.
Like Matthew said, 1912, like it wasn't just that, oh, some of the songs were that old. It's not that they were just old songs. They were old popular songs in their time. So we had already had 40 years of this guy. And like I said, and 12 years of a lot of his shows and a lot of that. So this is kind of later in his career, and he didn't go on to write many more new shows. He had just done Call Me Madam on Broadway before this. But after that, I think the only other two were that one that I mentioned, Lady Liberty, and then later Mr. President. And then in the 66 revival of Annie Get Your Gun, he wrote a new song, another counter melody, like that one at the beginning about Won't You Play a Simple Melody. That was the old-fashioned wedding number, which became a new Berlin standard even as late as 1966.
Now, that's a Broadway revival you're talking about? Because there was a television Annie Get Your Gun, apparently. It's like 67.
This was a Broadway revival in 66. I think the TV was trying to document.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay.
The Broadway revival. That's the one
we're lost. It doesn't exist.
Oh, okay.
It's too bad because, and some people had dubbed it because it was 20 years after the original production and Merman was in it. Some people did dub it Granny Get Your Gun.
Well,
Yeah. But thinking that this is Merman, this is 54, she is still 5 years away from doing Gypsy on Broadway, which would take her career in a whole other direction. And that's always interesting to think about where people are in their careers.
She had a long life, and she did so much television after that. So even if you were not a Broadway person, there were plenty of opportunities to see Merman in the 60s and 70s. And she did the Love Boat, didn't she, Matthew?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I saw the movie Airplane in the movie theaters in 1980.
Right. I was 12.
I was a 12-year-old. And I remember the joke about you hear in the hospital this awful, painful moaning. And he says, oh, that's Lieutenant Hurwitz. Severe shell shock. He thinks he's Ethel Merman. Cut to Ethel Merman jumping out of the bed, singing Everything's Coming Up Roses. I, at 12, laughed my ass off at that. I was like, I knew who Ethel Merman was. She was that old lady that sang in the loud voice on TV. She was absolutely ubiquitous to, you know, us Gen Xers who were raised on television.
Absolutely. And she, even though obviously she was an older person at that time, Ethel Merman always sang like Ethel Merman. And she was not somebody who, she's 60, her voice is slowed down. She's just not who she used to be. No, she was always, her lungs always worked very well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yet what you say about Gypsy was fascinating, too, because obviously Gypsy is a backstage musical, too. And so I couldn't help thinking about that when I was, you know, when the movie is starting and she's doing her first number. And I'm like, she hasn't even done Gypsy yet. Yeah. It's like, wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
But back to talking about Berlin. There's a sort of, you know, standard Americana musical theater-ness to him. But the score to Annie Get Your Gun is so good. And both the songs, Doing What Comes Naturally, and the song You Can't Get a Man with a Gun, both of those are brilliant lyrics because every stanza is a setup and joke, a setup punchline. Every single stanza has a new idea and a new punchline. You know, my tiny baby brother who's never read a book knows one sex from the other. All he had to do was look. The idea of just boom. And so many of them in those songs. So I think he was incredibly clever. I think there are Berlin songs that I think are him phoning it in. I don't know what that Michigas is that's snow in White Christmas, that stupid snow number. What is that?
See, I just think that's it, that there's so much volume with Berlin and so much of it got done, whether it was in more movies or plays.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, like, he's probably the composer who had more stuff recycled, not even into different mediums, but into the same, into different movies in the same, into different entities in the same movie. I mean, look, like I say, Alexander's Ragtime Band, Annie Get Your Gun has just happened in the movies 4 years ago. And I mean, his songs just kept reappearing. I think This Is the Army had repeats from, you know, back in his Broadway days, as you say, 1912. So the guy, just by sheer volume alone and by the fact that his music kept turning up, you kind of forget that there are gems in there that are clever and not what you sort of think of when you think, what's Irving Berlin? He's White Christmas. He's Annie Get Your Gun. He's No Business Like Show Business. Nothing wrong with those songs individually, but they're tropes, you know. It's a jukebox musical, as you were saying.
And speaking of Alexander's Ragtime Band, I would just like to go on record, Shelley, saying I do not care to hear the Swanee River played in ragtime.
No, thank you. Actually, and I really, that's one of my least favorite numbers in this movie. It's like, okay, we're going to do it. We're going to do it in the accents and the whole thing. I didn't like it the first time, and then we had to do it in French and then in Scottish broken. I hated that whole number.
Unrelenting is the word that I have written down here. And by the way, when we do this whole thing, first we have, Merman and, you know, the two Donahues and then the three and then the five and all that. We do have the bit of them at the train station with the kids and Ethel saying, this is no way to raise a family. We should put them in school. And then they grow up and then we have them headlining at the Hippodrome and all the different Alexander Ragtime huge mofo production numbers. And then the movie starts 26 minutes into the film. Really and truly, that is where the movie begins, when we start seeing them backstage chitty-chatting and, oh, Donald's going to go out with one of the girls and, oh, Mitzi's going to go to the club and the Johnny's going to go out for a walk because he's in a weird place and what is up with him and all that. But yeah, that Alexander, I was like, really? This was the, of all the Berlin catalog, this was the one that they thought was the song that we wanted to hear in German, in Scottish, in French.
It's your through line song. I mean, because it comes back and it's just like, why? But you have, I mean, and there's no business like show business doesn't come until late, which I mean, I understand why they did that. That makes sense. But it's just funny. Like if you have a big number like that and you make a choice, Alexander's Ragtime Band is the one which has fewer lyrics. Like even if it's a great, even if it was a great song, there's not a ton in there to work with. No. And they repeat it in lengths and accents. And I think we can agree about
that. That's a big misstep, so. I think. And again, the production values are insane. And I do have to say, Ethel and Dan sing it in German. Donald O'Connor sings it in Scottish. Mitzi Gaynor sings it in French. And Johnny Ray sings it in piano. They didn't even give him a country. They were like, God, this kid is so lousy.
Poor Johnny Ray. He shouldn't have done this movie. He really shouldn't have.
Bless.
No.
Bless his heart.
I think we're at final thoughts, gentlemen. Anything we haven't covered that we should have? Matthew, you have some merman to lay on us? Is something we need to know about Ethel in this movie that perhaps we don't?
Well, she was in an unhappy marriage as well to Bob Six, who was the president of Continental Airlines at the time. And she was trying to have a life on the West Coast. That's why she did Call Me Madam and then this movie. And I think she was missing New York, missing her parents. But I think this movie, we talk about the Berlin Trunk songs. We talk about the old-fashionedness of the show. This movie in 1954 was for people that were 54.
Oh.
Who heard Alexander's Ragtime Band and thought, oh, that was popular when I was a kid. You know? and I think, so for them to say in 1954, it's not hip and new. Well, no, it's not for kids. No 15-year-old was like, we got to go to the new Ethel Merman movie this weekend. You know? So I think this movie was for people to kind of tickle their memory bone, so to speak. And I love it because we get footage of Ethel Merman singing There's No Business Like Show Business in her prime, looking gorgeous as Ethel Merman can look.
She does look good. You're right.
I mean,
costumes are insane and so flattering, and not a single one of them looks like they're from the time period of 1919 to 1939. They look extremely contemporary, even the suits on the men. But I'm with you, Matthew. I don't care because it just looks gorgeous.
They're not doing
so
realism.
It doesn't matter.
They're not. I mean, that's not what this movie's about.
No.
It wants you to remember something the way you remember it. And I explained that with the revival of Hello, Dolly. They had this huge staircase for Carol Channing to come down. And she said to Leroy Reams, the director, you know, the staircase was basically made of cardboard in the original. And he said, but people don't remember it being, they remember you coming down a grand staircase. So they wanted people who were 54 in 1954 to remember vaudeville being as illustrious as it was and as colorful and as beautiful as it was. They wanted, it's a wonderful memory for people that lived through that time period, I think. Because people forget what a big star Ethel Merman was, I think.
That makes sense, too, because we're just about to get to the point where youth culture in planning and programming entertainment becomes much more of a deal, because that's the mid-50s. That's when rock and roll happens. And before that, you know, your sweet spot for audiences might not have been 54, but it certainly wasn't 15.
Right.
It was probably more like 30 or 40. And even if, you know, maybe you went with your parents, or maybe you just said, I sort of know what vaudeville is because I'm, you know, 35 or whatever.
Yeah.
So... And as I say, it made money. It wasn't 20th Century Fox didn't go, oh, we'll never do that again, which there were musicals in the 50s where that happened.
And having Marilyn as a presence in it, although you could say it is a weird thing to have a movie with Ethel Merman, Donald O'Connor, and Marilyn Monroe in them. You wouldn't really think of those as being grouped together. It's actually a wonderful thing because it is some of Marilyn's best musical work. You see that Heat Wave number. That is in pretty much every single Marilyn retrospective documentary. anywhere. Similar to Ethel singing No Biz Like Showbiz in the white dress. And the good thing about that is because of Marilyn's presence, that's why this film has had some longevity to it. That's why it did get rerun, because like Matthew's DVD cover, it's considered a Marilyn movie. Yeah. And that is definitely not a bad thing. If it's putting Ethel Merman's performance in front of new eyes who are tuning in to see a Marilyn movie, that's all the better, as far as I'm concerned.
It was a lot of fun. As I said before, I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. And that's only based on, I really enjoy Ethel Merman, but I wasn't sure. I was like, the quality of the movie, writing and direction, I think, is what impressed me. It looks so good. And Ethel Merman was as I expected her to be, but she's surrounded by enough other stuff that it makes the movie really entertaining. I also, the Blu-ray I got is really well done. The sound was excellent. I was actually really surprised by that. But the whatever, I mean, I assume it's stereo 5.1 or something like that. It's probably not anything super fancy, Dolby or whatever. But it really, for a 50s movie on moderately decent speakers, sounded very good. So it's a good, pleasant experience in your living room to watch on a big screen with good sound. I enjoyed it.
Yay!
Yay! You've convinced me. And thank you guys for recommending it. It's always fun to talk to people about movies that they recommended as opposed to something I've talked them into watching, which I've done many times before. That's always fun. David, Matthew, thank you so much for being on the show. It was delightful to have you. And why don't you just talk about Let's Face the Facts. What is this show all about?
Oh, it is a weekly rewatch podcast of the amazing 1980s sitcom, The Facts of Life. And I started it 4 years ago. Very soon thereafter, I realized I wanted it to be entertaining. So then I asked Matthew to join me. And now it's a lot more lively and funnier. And every single week we watch an episode in sequence. The show is winding down right now. But as of this recording, there are over 200 episodes. If you want to start back watching The Facts of Life, if you want to jump into our show, it is there. It will remain there. And we have so much fun doing it. And it's fun to know that there are a few people out there as obsessive as we are about this show that we loved from our childhood.
It's fun. I recommend it. Absolutely listen to it. And Matthew.
And you were a marvelous guest, Shelley. We had you on. If nothing else, listeners of this show, do a little search. Find Shelley on Let's Face the Facts.
Oh, I'll put it in the show notes. Why not? We'll do that. And okay. Yes, absolutely. Well, friends, if you want to know more about Lions, Towers, and Shields, please do yourselves a favor and go to theincomparable.com/LTS. You can subscribe. You can find show notes for this and all the podcasts. You can find out what's coming up next, which is a movie from 1959 called The Best of Everything. Also, you can find us on Twitter because, I mean, why not? We're gluttons for punishment at Lion Tower Shield because S's cost extra. We're also over on Mastodon at Lion Tower Shield because apparently S's cost extra there as well. And finally, you can write us at lts@theincomparable.com. Send us your feedback. Send us your suggestions for movies, which we may or may not take you up on it. Basically, it depends on having a champion on the panel, somebody who says, oh, no, we have to watch this movie. And that's how they happen. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in a week with another episode. Bye now.